Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. In a violation of all precedent, something in theory we should not fear, just one guest today, Aziz Rana, author of a new book on the constitutional fetish. Longtime listeners may have noticed that I'm no fan of the U.S. Constitution, a deeply undemocratic document that has been an essential foundation for plutocratic rule. Madison and the other founders were quite explicit about devising a governing structure that would incorporate elements of democracy, but all within a system that constrained popular power in the name of preventing mob rule. Thus, the Electoral College and the abomination that is the Senate. Don't take my word on the anti-democratic nature of what I once heard Howard Cosell call the world's greatest deliberative body. Here's a description from the Senate's own website. Madison explained that the Senate would be a necessary fence against the fickleness and passion that tended to influence the attitudes of the general public and members of the House of Representatives. George Washington is said to have told Jefferson that the framers had created the Senate to cool House legislation just as a saucer was used to cool hot tea. We the people need to be gagged now and then. Yet this document is venerated to a degree with few parallels elsewhere in the world. The Mormon Church officially believes it to be divinely inspired, a belief shared by 37% of white evangelicals and 18% of the overall U.S. population, according to a Pew poll. Here's Aziz Rana with a lot more. Aziz, a professor of law at Boston College, is just out with the constitutional bind, how Americans came to idolize a document that fails them, published by the University of Chicago Press. Aziz Rana. You teach at a law school. How does this sort of analysis go down among your colleagues?
It's a really interesting thing. We're living in a moment in which criticism of the Constitution, I think, is now becoming increasingly commonplace among constitutional law professors themselves, especially center-left, that there's an entire range of arguments about how the Constitution is pretty fundamentally undemocratic. The fact that representation is built around geography, not a principle of one person, one vote, how that ends up impacting gerrymandering in the House, the malapportionment of the Senate, the Electoral College, and then through the Senate and the presidency, the structure of who's on the Supreme Court. So Democrats have won 7 of the last 8 popular votes with the presidential election. But because of the Electoral College and the structure of the Senate, you have a supermajority, 6 justices nominated and confirmed by Republican presidents. So all of these things are now very commonplace, actually, among constitutional law professors. This is a moment that you're seeing play out within the legal academy, where the Constitution is routinely presented both as problem and then as solution. So that there's a recognition that we're living during this moment where American democratic institutions, to the extent that we can talk about American institutions as democratic, are really breaking down. And yet every time Trump or somebody on the right engages in attacks on electoral process, the response is to kind of double down on constitutional veneration. That's really more the challenge of the moment, both among the liberal commentariat, but then even within the legal academy, which is how to think outside the bind of understanding that there's a problem and yet hoping against hope that one can somehow turn back the clock or live in a nostalgic age where you can just still reinvest in the nostalgia. And I should say, as a last point about this, I really feel like this is something that the students are increasingly aware of, that they're coming into the classroom with an understanding of all of these big picture structural problems about American institutions, but then also a sense of the rolling social crises that the country's facing that our institutions seem paralyzed to address. The problem that the legal academy faces is that the entire infrastructure of the academy is built around a very limited range of debates about reform questions that elite law professors have in conversation with judges that seems completely disconnected from the world in which we operate.
As I was reading the book, I kept thinking of Bill Clinton's aphorism that what's wrong with America could be cured by what's right with America. It's just no way out of this perfect circle.
The framework that somebody like Clinton embodies is a romance about a Cold War national project that has a very particular way of thinking of the Constitution, that the Constitution is at the heart of that project, that the Constitution also goes hand in hand with this idea that the U.S. has been free and equal from the founding, that it's committed to anti-totalitarian civil liberties values, that those civil liberties are themselves tied to a commitment to property rights and to market capitalism, that all of that is also connected to a very restrained version of representative institutions with a powerful and insulated Supreme Court, and that together it's a justification for American exceptionalism and why the U.S. should enjoy global primacy. And that way of thinking of the country really solidifies and consolidates in the mid-20th century. It's what I call the official story of the creedal constitution. And it's what both political parties really found themselves committed to. What we're seeing really over the last half century is not just the consolidation, but the steady exhaustion of that framework for addressing the really profound problems, both internationally and domestically, that the U.S. finds itself confronted by. And the way in which this way of thinking about American life has not only led to a status quo in which our institutions are pretty profoundly undemocratic, but it's also facilitated an approach to the world that ends up promoting forms of discretionary violence overseas and then undercuts our capacity to really think in genuinely democratic terms. We're at a moment where we can finally think outside those truisms of creed and constitution that have so shaped the basic presumptions of how politicians have spoken to us for decades.
You've got to give the Founding Fathers credit for devising a system that looks democratic, but is actually an excellent foundation for plutocratic rule. It's quite a remarkable document.
It's important to understand like the context in which the federal constitution was drafted. On the ground in what would become the states, there was a kind of rippling of Euro-American settler little d democracy. So you had emerging arrangements that provided a great deal of direct political participation through strong legislatures, legislative supremacy to local farmers, artisanal workers, white laborers. And now this, of course, went hand in hand with really extractive forms of territorial conquest, the expropriation of indigenous land, the construction of labor regimes that were built around the coerced labor of non-settlers, particularly enslaved Black people. But for the insiders, there was a very rich flowering of democratic politics. But this was a kind of politics that by the latter part of the 1780s, you had a range of commercial and gentry elites that viewed as a threat to the long-term sustainability, not just of their rule, of like a powerful new nation. And so you have the construction of a constitutional system that on the one hand does actually commit itself to versions of representative government, but on the other hand sees the primary threat to rights, and here we're really talking about property rights, as coming from mass majorities and strong legislatures. And so sees the primary threats as demagogues, but demagogues tied to popular majorities. And what socialists at the end of the 19th, early 20th century said is that what this ignored was the other really clear threat to rights, and here the rights of most of the people that were landless or didn't have property. And that's from socioeconomic elites that embodied what Charles Edward Russell called an invisible government that could use their cultural and material resources to take advantage of all of the fractured elements of the American constitutional system to pose their will despite the fact that they didn't have popular support, and to undermine really the one thing that poor and working class Americans had, which was the power of the vote. And so you have a system that has elements, no doubt, of representative government, but that is framed around a presentation of threat that sees democracy as the primary threat. And then I would just add, for Black radicals and Black socialists from the latter part of the 19th century, all the way through large chunks of the 20th century, there was an additional argument, which is that this system also really set up a framework that made the most evident form of authoritarianism in the U.S. a brand of white authoritarianism, in which it was very easy for landed racial elites to assert control both over the economy and over the political process in ways that undermined the flourishing of something like a genuinely multiracial democracy.
There's been a tension between our founding documents, the Declaration, which we're all born free, everyone's equal, all that kind of Jeffersonian rhetoric, written, of course, by a slaveholder. But the Constitution is somewhat in opposition to that. It is not talking about, you know, the rights of all and universal equality. How have we dealt with that tension over the centuries?
I think it's right to highlight this question about to what extent did the two fit together. Now, the position of progressives and socialist activists and reformers, as well as academics, progressive academics like Charles Beard, at the beginning of the 20th century, was to say there's absolutely a tension, and that we should think of the Constitution as effectively a counter-revolutionary document, as a pushback against some of the principles in the Declaration. Now, it should be noted that the Declaration itself has a variety of different types of principles. There's the universally egalitarian language that we're all familiar with, but there's also the fact that the Declaration of Independence presents as grievances the idea that the English crown was not supportive enough of settler efforts to claim and expropriate indigenous land, that the English crown was also perceived as backing enslaved people. There's clearly a racial component to the framing of the grievances writ large. But nonetheless, at the beginning of the 20th century, one of the central narratives about the Constitution was a class-based narrative that viewed it as a constraint on democracy and a constraint on the democratic principles that flourished in 1776. The story of the 20th century has been a reconciling of the documents by embracing one strand of abolitionist argument. You had an anti-slavery argument during the Civil War and early Reconstruction associated with folks like Frederick Douglass, but also Lincoln, that said that the two documents should not be read as in tension, but that the Constitution should be thought of as a concrete instantiation of those principles in the Declaration of Independence. And that was a minority position, honestly, in the 19th century, because it was much more common to read the Declaration actually still as a charter of white liberty. This is Stephen Douglas, the senator from Illinois who engaged in the Douglas-Lincoln debates. That was his position, the Northern Democratic Party. And, you know, it was also much more common to think of the Constitution as providing a governing infrastructure for a white republic. But against the backdrop of two world wars, global decolonization, and the American emergence as a superpower in a very different world of the mid-20th century, in which even the European empires were not just collapsing, but reconstituting their identities on principles of liberal nationalism, that anti-slavery argument from the mid-19th century became a way in the 20th century to sort of reconstruct national identity. And then it became augmented by all of those other ideological commitments that I just described about civil liberties, market capitalism, the Supreme Court, and then American primacy. And all of these positions, including even connecting Declaration and Constitution, did not necessarily fit together. There's an uneasy relationship. But Americans came to tell a story of the country with the Constitution at the center that combined these uneasy ideological commitments into a single cohesive narrative that increasingly became what felt very familiar as the way that Americans spoke to each other about the meaning of the country. Even if, you know, let's say in the 19th century and certainly in the mid-19th or even in latter parts of the 19th century, it would have been quite unfamiliar. It would have been much more familiar to think of the country in the way that Teddy Roosevelt did, as defined by winning the West or as a white man's country that was not unlike settler siblings in South Africa or Australia.
I'm speaking with Aziz Rana, author of The Constitutional Bind, just out from the University of Chicago Press. There's a bit of a line of discourse throughout American history that the problem with our political structures is that some people have not yet been included in this wonderful structure, that women, black people, immigrants, indigenous populations have yet to be incorporated fully into the wonders of the American political structure. But once that happens, we'll reach perfection. Now, there's also another way of looking at it, which is those exclusions are really foundational to the whole system. What about that? Are those exclusions really foundational, or is it just a matter of incompleteness?
The classic way of thinking about American national identity that's a product of this creedal constitutional narrative is that the U.S. is just incompletely liberal. And so that if you include outsiders, then you'll be able to complete the national project. And that means that the primary problems in the present are laws that formally discriminate against groups and the fact that you don't ensure that, let's say, elites within historically marginalized communities have an equal opportunity to access positions of professional and political power. These are real problems, but I don't think that they get to the depth of the structural limitations or weaknesses that have marked American life. And this has to do with the ways in which this book on the Constitution connects to my first book called The Two Faces of American Freedom. We can understand large chunks of American history as organized around a politics of settlerism that combines really rich internal accounts of freedom and economic opportunity to external projects of territorial conquest and coerced labor. That infrastructure, even as the society's governing ideology moved toward creedal constitutionalism, even as explicitly segregationist laws were removed from the books, that infrastructure that affected the basic organization of American state and economy were not systematically addressed. It's why when during the Obama years, you could both have folks saying that the country was now quote unquote post-racial, but then if you just looked at issues of endemic poverty and questions around the carceral state, you could also say that the country was living through a second or new Jim Crow marked by hyper-incarceration and profound structural inequality. So what does that mean for the present? Absolutely, we need to eliminate some of the explicit exclusionary elements that continue to persist. And so I support, for instance, things like moving toward resident voting so that non-citizens can also vote.
Which was true in the early days of the country, right?
Absolutely. So that it was commonplace for European migrants, non-citizens, to have the capacity to vote really up through toward the end of the 19th century.
When the wrong kind of Europeans started arriving, right?
Exactly. So that shifted in the context of changing demographics around who was engaged in migration. And then certainly I think that we need to get rid of things like disenfranchisement on the basis of carceral status, folks that are previously imprisoned. But that's only one piece of the story. Alongside getting rid of explicit exclusions, it's also essential to think really systematically about the comprehensive infrastructure of our legal political processes. And that means understanding that a commitment to genuine democracy isn't just allowing more people a formal vote within a system that fractures the effective power of an idea committed to one person, one vote, but instead infusing the experience of democratic self-rule across all of the sites that shape American life. And that these were ideas that long-standing reformers within Black freedom politics, feminist politics, socialist politics, indigenous politics, and immigrant politics had across large swaths of American history. And yet one of the effects of the narrowing of the idea of what counts as a constitutional question to whatever it is that judges and elite lawyers discuss with respect to Supreme Court doctrine is that that entire constitutional memory and all of those constitutional actors have effectively been removed from the field of discussion.
The veneration of the Constitution has this quasi-sacred status. You make the point, among other things, that Jonathan Genap, is that how you pronounce his name?
Genap.
Yeah. The practice of amending the Constitution rather than altering the original text laid the groundwork for some of this veneration. That's a very interesting point. Could you expand on that?
My argument is not that there wasn't veneration and then veneration emerged in the 20th century. There have been periods of constitutional support and constitutional opposition that kind of rise and fall across American history. But it's also been the case that what Americans imagine that they're venerating when they're venerating the Constitution has shifted dramatically across time. So when I talk about the creedal Constitution, this is a 20th century vision of what Americans conceive of when they're talking about the text, where in the 19th century, perhaps the dominant way of talking about what was worth defending about the Constitution was the idea that it was a compromise. It was the compromise of 1787, that was a compromise over the question of slavery between the states, and so allowed the country to pursue territorial expansion, economic expansion, despite the disagreements about slavery. Now, if you just take a moment, you can see that is a very difficult ethical picture. In fact, antithetical to how Americans would now defend the Constitution. That's saying, effectively, the reason why the Constitution's worth defending at that time was that it avoided dressing slavery, the great moral sin of slavery, so that settlers could engage in territorial expropriation of indigenous peoples. I mean, this is the inverse of what we imagine today to be worth defending.
Well, then there's a civil war that made that impossible to say anymore.
So this is just to say that there's ebbs and flows. But at the same time, there's a really interesting question to be had about why the focus on text in the US in a way that I think is distinctive from many other societies that tend to think of constitutions as just rules for governing, and that maybe you write them down, maybe you don't. If you do write them down, they can be removed or gotten rid of. And some of that I actually do think has to do with the particular kind of Protestant commitments around text settlers brought, especially from England, where there was quickly a relationship to text that viewed it as to be read in a sense literally, but through the kinds of scriptural practices that you associate with the Bible. If the defining socially cohesive process in the United States in the 19th century was settlement, the last stage of territorial settlement was the holding of a constitutional convention and the writing of new constitutions. And that's absolutely bound up with the Protestant ethic and the association of text with that Protestant ethic. And at the federal level, this is the Gnapp argument, that the decision, which was not necessarily self-evident, that you would add amendments to the text, also then emphasized this particular way of reading or conceiving of constitutions in scriptural terms. There's certainly a religious foundation that was tied to the process of settlement that shaped how Americans came to conceive of text and constitutional text. But once you get past that point, and especially by the time you get to the late 19th, early 20th century, that's a period of really intense disillusionment and critique of the Constitution for many of the reasons now we criticize it, that it's not particularly democratic, that it's aiding business interests, that it's sustaining white supremacy. So that all of those arguments were on the table. And then a country essentially through a set of really intense processes that are tied once more to the US's emergence onto the global stage and establishment as a superpower in an era of decolonization comes to rally around the Constitution as a way of telling a very different story about nation.
Those state constitutions you mentioned, none of them really imitated the federal structure, right? All those Madisonian elements to limit popular power were not imitated at the state level, were they?
No, there's some terrific comparative constitutional scholars, so Emily Zak and Mila Versteeg, that have written about the exceptionalism of the American federal constitution. And by this, they don't necessarily mean it in a positive sense. They just mean that the U.S. federal constitution is distinctive because of how different it is than most constitutions around the world and even than state constitutions. It's much shorter. It's like 7,600 words. The average constitution globally is 20,000 words. The Indian constitution is 150,000 words. It has far fewer positive rights provisions, socioeconomic rights, women's protections, reproductive rights, environmental rights. It is far harder to amend, perhaps the hardest constitution in the world to amend. And each of these elements of the U.S. federal constitution were just not imitated by states on the ground. That fact is part of the story in the 19th century and the early 20th century of the federal constitution. In other words, in the 19th century, social cohesion in the U.S. was not established through a story that was centered around the federal constitution, even if some people engaged in a kind of sacralized or religious language about the document. It was really the process of territorial settlement. Most politics took place at the state level or indeed even at the local level. And because of that, the structure of Madisonian federalism really didn't get in the way of what a lot of actors were pursuing. And it meant that when it came time for local settlers to come up with how they wanted to organize their political arrangements, they oftentimes very consciously just rejected the Madisonian approach of really intense checks and balances, massive constraints on legislative power, very strong judiciaries, very strong presidential authorities. And they moved instead to documents that were much longer, that constrained judicial power. It was commonplace in the 19th century to have elected judges, for instance, that had much stronger legislative branches, that looked much more like legislatively supreme arrangements, majoritarian arrangements, that had more expansive socioeconomic rights. All of this not only highlighted the fact that there was a kind of recognition among many local elites, as well as ordinary farmers and workers, Euro-American farmers and workers, that the federal constitution was not necessarily a model to replicate if you actually wanted to construct something like a democratic practice. But it also, interestingly, was a pressure release valve for the federal constitution. because of the fact that the federal constitution wasn't as significant for your daily experience, and that you could arrange institutions in a way that was quite different, it meant that you could have a type of surface fidelity to the federal constitution while at the same time operating in a very different way in your local politics. And it's why the first sustained period of intense constitutional conflict emerges through the issue of slavery and the construction of a new national and industrialized economy that intensifies conflicts between labor and business, because it's really that mid and then the late 19th century where you can't avoid Madisonian federalism because it's now imposing such a vice grip on politics, given that politics is increasingly less what the historian Robert Wiebe called organized around a society of island communities. Politics is much more nationally framed.
We're listening to an interview with Aziz Rana, a professor of law at Boston College and author of The Constitutional Bind from the University of Chicago Press. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News, back after a musical break. Some of Escher Dreamlike from a new album by friend of Behind the News, Bergsonist. And now the second part of my interview with Aziz Rana, a professor of law at Boston College and author of The Constitutional Bind from the University of Chicago Press. And then there's also the transformation as the 19th century went on from that artisanal, yeoman, independent white guy model of the early part of the century that Jefferson revered so, to one of proletarianization, industrialization, urbanization. How did the Constitution live with that kind of social transformation?
That social transformation, alongside the effects of the Civil War, really end up shaping the debates 100 years ago. The big effect of the Civil War is that if the Civil War was supposed to be avoided because the Constitution was a constitution of compromise among the states around the question of slavery, it had failed. And so folks were dealing with, well, what are the implications of this governing document if it had not been able to head off such cataclysmic violence? And then for Black people who were really the primary backers during Reconstruction of the Constitution because of the Reconstruction Amendments, their experience of seeing those amendments essentially turned into a dead letter produced really intense conflicts around whether or not the Constitution was worth backing. Then at the same time, industrialization had these huge effects because the society is racked by internal class conflicts, even within white Euro-American settler society. And those internal class conflicts are sort of undermining the idea that this is a society that uses various kinds of racial controls to ensure a degree of social mobility and social equality for all insiders. And the Constitution seems to be a very significant part of the problem because, to begin with, it's the federal courts starting the latter part of the 19th century that are undermining the labor legislation, the various kinds of socioeconomic provisions that majoritarian legislative branches are pursuing. And then it's not just an issue of the courts. Increasingly, there's a recognition that the entire infrastructure of the federal government is deeply undemocratic. Not only do you have these lifetime judges, you also have a president that can win based on an electoral college. You have the construction of the Senate that before 1913 wasn't even directly elected by voters. You have all the issues around gerrymandering. And that you have an entire infrastructure that facilitates, again, that invisible government of power by socioeconomic elites and undermines the capacity of poor and working people to use the vote. And it leads to a whole range of reform ideas. For instance, the Socialist Party of America's 1912 platform, which is really based on a very different design vision for how to organize a constitution. And the thought is that to have a genuine democracy, you have to have a constitutional system that allows organized majorities to negotiate and renegotiate the institutions of government through a system that looks much more like a mass parliamentary democracy. So multi-member districts, the abolition of the Senate, a simplified amendment process, structural changes to the court, limitations on presidential authority. And all of this is supposed to go hand in hand with a much more expansive provision of basic rights, both negative rights, civil liberties protections, but also positive socioeconomic rights and protections for labor so that you can have intermediate institutions between citizens and the government that can mobilize, organize, and effectively represent the public in ways to ensure that you don't have overreaching power that's being asserted either by a powerful state, and especially a national security state, or by business interests. And that's a very different way of thinking of a constitution. It's one that doesn't think of a constitution as a fundamental law that is insulated from ordinary politics, but understands constitutional politics as a site for continuous democratic energy.
To take up a different topic, the colonization of the Philippines, how does that fit into the constitution story?
So my argument is that while there are clear internal domestic moments and developments that lead to the consolidation of this new way of thinking about the constitution, creedal constitutionalism, that you cannot tell the story of the rise of 20th century constitutional veneration without locating it against the backdrop of international relations and the transformations in the nature of American power. One of the ways that I highlight that is by noting that one of the earliest moments for seeing this consolidation around the idea that the Constitution should be read through the Declaration of Independence as a universally egalitarian document actually comes to the fore among a range of political elites in the Philippines. So following Reconstruction, that view of linking creed and constitution together falls out of favor, basically, within white society, and it becomes a kind of marginal or tangential position. It's much more common to talk and think about the U.S. as an explicitly white republic. To speak about Teddy Roosevelt again, Roosevelt sends part of the Pacific Fleet on a tour of Australia and New Zealand, saying that just like the U.S., Australia and New Zealand are also white man's country. And he's doing this because Japan had just defeated Russia in war in 1904, 1905. That's a kind of way of thinking about the country that's more commonplace. But what happens in the Philippines is that in a background of social crisis, intense class conflict, there's a growing move among a range of political and economic elites to say that perhaps the country can be cohered again by opening up new markets, by finding new colonies that can then bring in wealth to the country, and that the U.S. should participate in the same scramble for colonial land that other European powers have participated in. So there's the Spanish-Cuban-American War. The U.S. finds itself after the victory in that war with massive new colonies from Puerto Rico all the way to the Philippines. But then something happens. Almost immediately in the Philippines, the U.S. finds itself confronting an indigenous anti-colonial independence movement. And just as a condition of maintaining basic control over the Philippines, the U.S. ends up having to hand over power to some range of local elites and to create mediated forms of self-government for Filipinos. And still, there's conflict back and forth. A quarter of a million Filipinos are killed in a really, really brutal counterinsurgency that the U.S. engages in. But all of this is highlighting something, which is that the U.S. is a latecomer to the imperial project, and that the world of decolonization is already starting to pick up. And it raises a question for American administrators, which is, if just as a condition of maintaining power in places like the Philippines in the first decade of the 20th century, you have to give power back effectively to Filipinos, how can you justify your presence? And what Republican officials do, and it's important that they're Republicans because they have a link to the old anti-slavery arguments, is they say, well, the reason why the U.S. is there is because the U.S. is not an empire. It's not engaged in extraction like England or France or other powers, but instead it's motivated by the principle of constitutionalism, by the way in which this federal constitution is tied to the Declaration and is a gift for the world, and that the U.S. is essentially there just for as long as it's necessary to engage in a tutelary project, unquote. Now, this is obviously you know, deeply racist because it's based on the idea that non-European peoples are less, quote unquote, mature or politically developed, and so that they have to be handheld toward constitutional government. And it tells us something about what's happening in the early part of the 20th century, which is the link of creed and constitution, an idea that for somebody like Frederick Douglass is a deeply revolutionary concept that has real potential threats that it imposes on a society built around white supremacy during Reconstruction, is being reimagined as not just a language of reform, but also a language to legitimate the hierarchies and structures that exist. And so the Philippines becomes this really interesting early test case for administrators working out how they're going to conceive of the meaning of American power, and even how they're going to combine presumptions about racial hierarchy with ideas about creedal constitutionalism. And then at this point, it's still a minority position. There's lots of opposition to whether or not the U.S. should engage in extensive overseas possessions or global dominance. But over the course of the first half of the 20th century, World War I, World War II, and certainly the Cold War, this becomes increasingly the language that justifies American power. It becomes augmented with those other principles about civil liberties and market capitalism and American primacy, such that by the time you get to the Cold War in the mid-20th century, it's just the natural way that American elites come to talk about the meaning of American global power and the terms of domestic reform.
The New Deal. The Supreme Court did not like the New Deal. There seemed to be rich possibilities there for reconstructing the constitutional order. There was the court packing incident, but really, we emerged from the 1930s without much of a change in the constitutional order. What happened?
It's really important to appreciate the extent to which the 1930s, perhaps the last time where you could have imagined a mobilized majority base for really fundamental changes to the constitutional system and to the system of electoral government. That even as you have the kind of picking up, we're talking about this with the Philippines, of arguments by elites about constitutional veneration, there is really bedrock criticism that comes through socialist and progressive and even the legacies of American populism. All of this is swirling in the 1930s. And it's something that New Dealers recognize. The people around FDR are not venerators of the Constitution. They have profound criticisms, many of the criticisms that folks today hold. The disagreements they have are about, do you need to rewrite the text, or can you graft onto the existing constitutional system a new structure of presidential administration that gets you the things that you need?
That has its roots in the progressive era too, right?
Absolutely. It has its roots in the progressive period. It has its roots in the presidencies of both Teddy Roosevelt and Wilson, who similarly increasingly make arguments that there's less fixed in this constitutional system than the critics that want a new document might appreciate, that you can play with the joints. That's essentially the New Deal era debate. And it's even the debate around what's the meaning of court packing, so that the courts are striking down legislation that's incredibly popular, that's sort of necessary for addressing the economy. All of the different New Deal sides, the folks that want a new document and the folks that think you don't need a new document, support the idea of reforms to the court system and even expanding the number of judges on the court. And I should say, the U.S. having only 9 Supreme Court judges is an outlier. Most countries that have Supreme Courts tend to have larger numbers. Germany's equivalent court has 16 justices. India has 34. So 9 is very small. So the idea of expanding to 15 was, you know, broadly supported. But there were different kinds of intentions behind it. One perspective was this is a way of opening up the court system to deal with the immediate problem of the court striking down massively popular legislation, but then with the hope of a reconstructive agenda to deal with the states in particular. So somebody like W.E.B. Du Bois supports court packing, but says that the central problem is what he called in book Color and Democracy from 45, the quote unquote national taboo around dealing with a system of representation built around states rather than people, geography rather than one person, one vote, and that you needed to alter the electoral infrastructure to actually produce something genuinely democratic. FDR was on the one hand viewed the central threat during this period as quote unquote economic royalists, business elites that were deeply suspicious of democracy. But he was also concerned about social revolution and the socialist possibilities that might erupt from the left. and was wary of just opening up the political system to something like a constitutional convention or more far-reaching change. He preferred to house the debate within the presidency, because the thing about court packing is that you could then perhaps shift constitutional meaning through presidential appointments of judges. And then he also liked the focus on administration, because you could have an administrative apparatus that, again, was closely tied to presidentialism. I should say that there were incredible experiments during this 1930s period. So there's wonderful scholars like Kate Andreas and Willie Forbath and Joey Fishkin that have discussed this, where there was an effort to create within, for instance, the legislation around labor standards or around collective bargaining, tripartite arrangements that would give unions real decision-making authority over how to construct key elements of the economy. The problem, of course, and this is the bigger story, is that if you didn't address the basic infrastructure of American representative government, you were still going to have those Jim Crow conservative senators shaping what legislation gets passed, who gets nominated to the administrative branches, the administrative apparatus, who ends up on the courts, and effectively containing whatever potential the New Deal could pursue. So FDR in 38 knows that he's going to have to get rid of some of these Jim Crow politicians in order to be able to fulfill elements of the New Deal. But to the extent that he's both hesitant to directly address the question of white supremacy, that he wants to tiptoe around it, and to the extent that he refuses to take seriously the need for constitutional transformations to the electoral system, you have left embedded within the American political project this infrastructure of effectively white authoritarianism and economic autocracy. And it's that legacy that's the stuff that we're dealing with today. In other words, that New Deal period absolutely produced a significant amount of constitutional transformation. But in a way, the present is one in which we're dealing with what the costs are of the path taken, and the fact that the country didn't have a genuine reconstruction of its basic institutions of state. And so now again, we're dealing with, well, what are the consequences of having an entire electoral and political system that's basically organized around minority rule?
I'm speaking with Aziz Rana, author of The Constitutional Bind, just out from the University of Chicago Press. All right, jumping ahead a few decades, since time is passing, coming out of the 60s and early 1970s turmoil, we then had a constitutional restoration. How did that happen?
There's many reasons why the 1970s ends up producing sustained backlash against left politics in the 60s and early 70s. And I should say that's a period of really maybe the last before our own flowering of criticism about the Constitution and transformative agendas. And you see this with student movements, Black radical internationalist movements, indigenous politics, thinking about a whole range of possibilities to deal with both the settler and undemocratic infrastructure of the country, everything from expansive rights protections to shared sovereignty for indigenous peoples to demobilizing of the carceral and national security apparatus. But the problem for those activists is that, unlike in a way the first three decades of the 20th century, from the SPA, Socialist Party of America, through the New Deal, there just isn't a mass white working class base that you can tap into. You just can't get majority support. And this has to do with a number of features, that the successes of the New Deal period kind of ended up counterintuitively reducing some of the insurgent potential within white working class politics. The transformations of the economy and of neighborhoods, the rise of the suburbs, shifted the consciousness and cultural identity of white workers, so that really more and more of those folks identified as middle class or with employers rather than necessarily with employees or workers across various types of racial divides. You also have, in the late 60s and early 70s especially, a basic transformation in the structure of the American economy. So this is a period in which you're starting to see the decline in real incomes, the collapse of the classic manufacturing frameworks. And then you also have the country exiting an era of really intense conflict over questions of race, but also Vietnam. And here the drawdown in the war in Vietnam plays a significant role, because where the Vietnam War had highlighted a kind of crisis of American institutions, namely the fact that in the Democratic Party, you can see this in the lead up to the 68 election, the majority of people were voting for candidates like RFK or Eugene McCarthy opposed to the war. And yet you have the Democratic candidate in Humphrey supportive effectively of the war. And so that raises questions about to what extent can this political process work. The drawdown with respect to the Vietnam War essentially reduces some of the pressures around the existing system. And it creates a climate by the time you get to the bicentennial of the Declaration in 76, where there's a real desire to essentially turn the page on past conflicts and to engage in a national outpouring of reverence for founders, for restoration, for self-congratulation. And all of that promotes what I call in the book a culture of originalism, of thinking of the founders as worthy of being replicated in the present, even seeing the founders, despite the fact that somebody like Madison was an enslaver, in future successes, like the successes of the civil rights movement. So you have even the living constitutional traditions of saying that the Constitution changes over time as still tied to a type of founders worship. And all of that, I then think, creates a real opening for the right, where the right's wariness of the racial, economic, and gender shifts that had taken place in the 60s and 70s has a language that it can hold on to. It can say that just like the center left, the right too is committed to originalism, to the vision of the founders. And if the founders were so great, if there's such a desire for restoration, why don't we go back to the world of 1789 or 1868? And that even if a methodologically serious lawyer that's interested in the intentions of the founders might not in every single question produce an outcome that is consistent with what the new right might want in the 1980s, a broader political climate that sees solutions to the late 20th century in a almost scriptural relationship with the text of framers from the 18th century is one that's certainly more conducive to political reaction. I mean, it's not a framework for thinking in an exploratory and open way about, you know, a future of genuine democracy.
And then finally, we have the last few minutes of an interview reserved for the what is to be done question. There seems to be a broad consensus that we've got some serious problems. People across the political spectrum have different points of view on what those problems are. But I think there's a pretty broad consensus that something is fundamentally wrong here. Now, the obstacles to overhauling this system seem very forbidding. There's still an awful lot of constitutional veneration around. It's impossible to imagine small states conceding the abolition of the Senate, for example. A constitutional convention with a broad remit to rewrite the thing, with neo-Nazis in the march, and the business class very powerful and assertive, that seems scary. Are we stuck with this thing until climate change does us all in?
My view is that I think you're right to say that the obstacles to the type of transformation that I'd want to see are very serious. It's one of the many binds of the book's title. The book's called The Constitutional Bind. And I think one of the ways of framing the bind is something we started with in talking about left of center constitutional law professors, which is there's a recognition that these institutions don't work. There's even actually a fairly broad set of policy changes that have support across left and even liberal or center political spaces. But the question of how to get there feels really hard. My response to that is it highlights that at the end of the day, the way we're going to get out of the bind is not really through technical legal expertise. It's not about, is there some policy solution that will somehow unlock the system? It's rather that actually, probably the first set of steps are steps that you might not even associate with constitutional politics. And that's about building and really rebuilding the intermediate institutions that can house movements and that can ensure that there's countervailing power that's established for working people. If we think about one of the big changes between now and the early 20th century and why there was the possibility of majority support for fairly radical alterations to the constitutional system, one of the reasons had to do with the strength of the labor movement as a site for multiracial, class-conscious political organizing. It's not just unions, but it's organizations like unions that need to be reconstructed, strengthened, so that you can house broader forms of movement politics. And you can even see this globally. the places that have had either successful or near successful dramatic constitutional changes, new constitution writing experiments, they've oftentimes been tied to mass movement organizing and politics, with labor, left-wing churches, parties, student movements, all centrally involved in providing locations or spaces for building up those types of arguments. Right now, we're at a moment where we have to confront those questions as well. A historian of populism that's been an influence for me is Lawrence Goodwin. Goodwin argued that the central project of populism in the latter part of the 19th century was moving Americans, this is especially farmers and workers, from a received culture to a movement culture, such that the ideas of the left effectively just emerged organically in their daily experiences of workplaces, schools, and neighborhoods. And it's that kind of, I think, reconstructive project that's essential now. That means policy reforms that address housing, that deal with the resegregation of American life, that make our workplaces much more democratic, that would allow this linkage between the material demands that people have and the nature of our constitutional system to feel much more clearly joined together. Now, of course, the problem is that this is a medium to long-term project that I'm articulating. And the present is one in which you have the specter of a dangerous far right, and you have the reality of an exhausted political center embodied by Biden that's promoting various versions of discretionary violence in places like Gaza, while at the same time compromising our democratic principles here at home. And so it feels like we're operating with two different time horizons. And that, of course, then requires two different ways of participating politically and strategically. But this sort of mode of seeing constitutional change as part of a general kind of mass movement politics to shift the terrain of American life, that feels like that's the best pathway going forward.
That was Aziz Rana, a professor of law at Boston College and author of The Constitutional Bind from the University of Chicago Press. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, some of Ween al-Milyin, Arabic for Where Are the Millions, and apologies for my brutalizing that language, by the Lebanese singer Julia Boutros in a remix by the Tunisian DJ and producer Dina Abdelwahed. Till next week, bye.